this week's Two Men in the Middle. This is where two men in the middle of the country talk about politics, current events, and other fun stuff. I'm Craig Huey.
I'm Brandon Kinnig.
I'm Jason Peterson.
Gentlemen, we did that without practicing, too.
Yeah. Success.
That might be the first time we've done that that smoothly. So, Brandon, we wanted to start off on Trump and his lawsuit, correct? That he filed some big tech lawsuits this week.
He did. He's trying to find some way to stay relevant and keep his name out there as he teases a 2024 presidential run. So he filed these lawsuits against the big tech platforms, against Facebook and Twitter, for kicking him off, seeking damages. Most legal analysts believe that this is not going to go anywhere, that these lawsuits are going to be tossed out. And I think the larger game for Trump is not the lawsuits themselves or having any type of successful return from these. It's really just using these as a platform for raising money and grifting, which is what he's good at. So as of on cue, I started getting emails and text messages from the Trump campaign, even though I'm not signed up to get either, but they are very bad about just harassing people.
Brandon, you can just admit it. You want those emails. You're in marketing as a profession. You've got
gives you something to talk about.
I mean, it does.
You've had to learn so much from Trump's email campaigns and ask, I would think.
But I find it fascinating that somebody who talks ad nauseum about his wealth and how successful he is hitting up people, primarily blue collar supporters, for money to fund these lawsuits and saying that we need help with legal fees. Help us, donate now. So it's a big grift operation. And the text messages and the emails themselves use this ridiculous language. It parallels the language that was used during the campaign and after the campaign when he was doing the election lawsuits and he raised millions, hundreds of millions off of that. But it's language saying donate now for a 6x impact with your donation. I mean, almost sounds like casino, like jackpot type language. Like we've upped it to 6x impact right now, but you got to donate today to get the 6x. What is a 6x impact?
Yeah.
I don't know, but it's the same language he used during the election lawsuit thing. And then they would change it to like 4x impact or 10x impact. And it would just be random. What does that even mean? What is the
There's
impact?
Somebody like you there doing this A-B testing. Which number works best? Right. Send that one out.
Oh my gosh, I'm going to donate now because my donation will be a 7x impact.
Jason, I hate to disagree, but there's nobody with branded skill, intelligence, or integrity doing anything for Trump's campaign.
Yeah, totally fair on that. Yeah. They have
happening.
The loose concept and they're trying to execute on it.
But it's so ridiculous and pathetic and just it also screams gimmicky. I mean, right? You hear that language, it's like, really? So that's what he's doing. I mean, he's still trying to raise money and people that are gullible and willing to apparently donate to him. And there's enough of those people around. What we saw from the rally he held in Ohio a couple weekends ago was that many of those people that showed up had no idea the Senate race that was coming up next year. They don't know who the players are. They don't know what's going on with that congressional race with Gonzalez, but they were there to see Trump because they're living in this fantasy where they still believe Trump is president and he's going to be returned to the White House. Those are the people he's relying on because those are the people that are going to donate because, frankly, they don't care about anything else, but they do care about Trump.
Well, you used the word gullible, which to me is aligning with some of this, right? Because there still seems to be this huge misconception about the First Amendment, which, Trump's backed by a bunch of lawyers on this one. I don't understand how they call themselves lawyers, but in this case, they're saying his First Amendment protections have been violated because he's not able to speak on Twitter or Facebook, which is completely false, right? And First Amendment does not protect you from private entities enforcing their own rules and keeping you off of their platforms.
So the legal theory of the case, as I understand it, so again, I got my Twitter lawyer on, and the only way that this works is if they can prove that the company was acting on behalf of the state. There is a legal principle and a precedent. I want to say it was like a mining company and something to do with their union, that if the state tried to ban, if the state tried to make a run at free speech, but then they got the company, if they directly pressured the company to then ban it, that is illegal. And that, I believe, is that's the hook they're trying to. That's what they're trying to say.
But that wouldn't apply here because Trump was president still when he was banned. So he was the state. I mean, so you can't say that there was pressure.
Yeah, and it was more than one platform. So it's more than one company and more than one state.
So So you also could make the argument that when the CDC came out with their guidelines and they worked with Facebook, YouTube, Google as an extension of the CDC to enforce these guidelines on their users. That's another theory that they are throwing out. Nobody that I have read has said that this lawsuit is worth its salt. Nobody expects it to move forward. And this falls squarely into what we talked about last week, Brandon. This is just performative.
Oh, it is.
By
performance policy. But even if you're looking at it from that narrow view of like COVID misinformation, I think that the defense of the social media companies would say it was more than just that. I mean, it was his conduct and what he said on January 6th. It was the incitement. And so there's so many other reasons. And each of those companies has their own moderation policies. If they had like a single moderation policy, but because they're so different, for example, Facebook, I routinely revisits their blocking of Trump, and they've already done that once, where Twitter, I believe, did a lifetime ban on Trump. So I think that that's also goes into the defense on their part, because it's not like there's this singular policy that they're in, in cahoots on, or that they're, you know, it's different policies and they've taken that action independently.
There's just such rich hypocrisy here. I mean, the same guy who complains he doesn't have a voice because he's been blocked from Twitter and Facebook is sending out massive email campaigns to raise money. He's the guy who said, you know, UV lights and hydrochloroquine help you, and he's the guy who incited violence on January 6th. He has a voice. Millions and millions of people hear and listen to him. Him not having a voice on Twitter and Facebook is completely irrelevant to him getting his message out.
And, well, and I would
he's
think
still so upset about that.
The ultimate comeback would be like, if it matters so much, why don't you start your own communications platform? Oh, wait, he did, and it failed. And you have people like Mike Lindell, who started his Frank, which failed. Like, all of these attempts have failed. And I think Parler is still out there. Like, it's come
it
back,
is.
But it's, I don't think it's doing well. I feel like it's just stumbling. It's not had.
Have you checked out Getter?
No. Which one is this? This is
GETTR.com. This is Jason Miller.
Oh, okay.
Who was Trump's director of communications.
He's a horrible person, by the way.
He's
you can look
total,
into his past.
Yeah. That's not hyperbole. He is a giant piece of shit.
Right.
So he started another Twitter-style knockoff called Getter. It's a big, giant turd, too.
That's a circa 2000 there. You drop a vowel and use that as your...
It has no unique value prop in terms of how it operates. That's right, because I remember reading about this, and there was a lot of criticism. It's like, so what's the selling point here?
I can't think of it. The only selling point I guess is there's no censorship. You can pretty much say whatever you want.
You know, that's ironic because they always say that starting out, but even like Mike Lindell's platform, they were censoring people that disagreed with them. So there were people get on there and like argue with them and say, no, that's not accurate. And then they started banning those users. The same thing happened on Parler. Parler has been criticized since it came out over the last 4 or 5 years for banning users who they didn't agree with. So, you know, these platforms could be free speech as long as it's the speech
it's
they agree
free
with.
Speech, yeah.
Right.
So this feels like just another swing at the First Amendment. This is obviously performative by Trump to signal to his base, I'm still fighting. This is a fight I pick. I will fight for you in the big tech space and put whatever definition on that you want. But once again, I am fighting for something for you against some huge bully that has done you wrong in some way. So this is Trump 101 and really combining his two passions, political speak and suing people, which is really what he's done most of his career. The lawsuit on its face value seems to be without merit, but there are folks out there like Hugh Hewitt and other people in the conservative space that are still somewhat serious, who are giving this lawsuit some credence by saying, while this isn't the First Amendment today, is this a preview of what the First Amendment should be? Are we quickly developing an appetite for looking at the First Amendment and redefining what that means? I know that's scary as hell, but it certainly feels like this is a trial balloon to see what we get out of this.
It's just the appearance of anger, though. If they don't really intend to get anything done, and to Brandon's point, they're going to raise a bunch of money and rile up the base, and that's it. I think if I can't imagine most people would want the First Amendment to change, but
I can't.
I also don't feel like I'm blocked out of these platforms.
But the dangerous side of this is that even if they're using it just as a money raising operation, the more that they continue to harp on it and echo this,
you repeat
refrain,
the lie over and over.
You repeat
and over
it,
again.
People begin to believe it and say, "We need to change it. The existing, it's not working, and we need to mandate that, you know, this type of speech is allowed, regardless of platform." Platform, regardless of company. And then that really draws in a question and creates a whole new paradigm where anything and everything is allowed. And as a content provider, you have no control over what's allowed or not. It also continues to open the door for lawsuits, right? Because if you are not able to police because of the law, what's controlled, how does libel lawsuits and so forth play into that? I mean, there's a whole side of the law where it then becomes difficult as a content provider because of the liability. And then do you even want to open yourself up to that? So there's so many problems that come from it.
These groups just don't care enough about the Constitution. I mean, doesn't the language start with Congress shall create no law or shall not create a law, however it's phrased, right? It's Congress. It's not talking about a private company or an individual infringing upon your rights here.
So
it's the government.
I'll play devil's advocate for 1 second. So if I am the lawyer on Trump's side, and I love the fact that when he introduced his legal team, he said he went out and got big tobacco lawyers. I don't know what that was an indication of, but okay. So if I am Trump's lawyer, the first witness I call is Dianne Feinstein. And I say, Senator Feinstein, on some date of this year on the Senate floor, you said to Twitter, if you don't clean this up, we will. What did you mean by that? Was that a threat? Did you mean to take government influence and insert it over Twitter to get them to change their policy? What did you mean when you said clean this up or we will? And then I'd bring in about 50 other politicians that have said the exact same thing and said, you tell me. Is this pressure? Is this threats? How should we take it when a sitting United States senator and other politicians directly reach out to a private company and tell them you will do this or there will be consequences? If that's not direct government pressure, then what is?
That's the violation of the First Amendment.
Correct.
Right there.
I don't think that argument goes anywhere, but I certainly would want to make that an open court. I would certainly want to start connecting these dots that if you're going to use that type of language, shouldn't you expect these types of challenges?
Well, the frustrating thing here too is the noise drowns out the little bit of signal that exists. So we've talked before here about section, is it 520? Got it. I talked about 230. I forgot the number.
I thought you were going to say section 420. Yeah.
I thought that's where you were going with that.
Like, wait a minute. Talked before about section 230, and there seems to be some reasonable policy discussions that could occur around changing that language, tightening it up, manipulating what its purpose is, and that's all gone now, and now we're talking about the First Amendment. Okay.
And isn't it if Trump gets his way, he basically breaks the internet? Are we willing to give up comment sections and treating these companies like publications, just as utilities? Does this lawsuit put all of that in jeopardy?
Well, it does because if you
Trump
treat
wins,
them,
Brandon,
if you treat them as public utilities and increase the liability to that degree, they are not going to have comment sections. They're not going to allow any of that. So these platforms that we have become reliant on would change drastically overnight because companies like Facebook and Twitter would be like, it's not worth the liability.
Yeah, Twitter's all about comments.
Yeah.
Facebook is all about comments. If you take that away, the internet fundamentally changes. And the question is, why? Why do we this impacted one man? I think too, if I'm Trump's lawyer, how do I show that this impacts more than him? Because I can't find a way to break this out to say this impacts more than just Donald Trump. Because Donald Trump's hook and his offer, I guess, to the people he's selling this to is, I am fighting this battle so you don't. When he ended his little statement from the desk thing, he basically said, if they're doing it to me, they're doing it to you. So this Trump is trying to put everybody as a straw man that what's happened to him is happening to them. I don't see any evidence of that happening.
That's the huckster element of it, right?
Correct. And when did conservatives, I guess we've totally forgot about freedom of association. Does that just not apply anymore? Do I not have the ability in this country to hang out and do business with the people that I choose to do business with? Are we sacrificing that to preserve the First Amendment? Can't those two go hand in hand?
You would think, and I think that's been some of the most difficult part of all of this is just giving up these core conservative tenets completely. J.D. Vance made some comments like that. Let me see if I can find them. That actually struck me as just really unbelievable. He said voters really want us to do something about the tech industry, and they say things to me like, "I love what you said, but why can't we break up these companies and just put all the CEOs in jail?" So the fact that the fact that J.D. Vance has gone completely like populist, authoritarian populist, and doesn't push back on these people and just indulges them and like, "Oh yeah, I completely agree. Like these CEOs should be in jail."
Did you hear what he said about his support for Trump this week?
Oh yeah.
So J.D. Vance had to go back and delete a bunch of tweets that he made in 2016, where he basically said, "What the hell's wrong with this guy? This guy is reprehensible. We should go nowhere near him."
Which, by the way, J.D. Vance actually voted for McMullen in 2016, and he said that Trump would be a disaster. He told his book editor, that Trump would be a disaster for the country, but good for book sales.
Wow. So
that was on point.
When pushed on that, now he comes out and he basically said, "Hey, Trump's the leader of the party. I'm just going to suck it up and follow him."
He said
that was his verbatim.
Yep. That he just needs to suck it up and support him. He's the leader of the party. So that is not a leader. That is a follower. And he's basically telling us that he has relegated himself to just following and doing whatever Trump says.
Doesn't that disqualify you from being a United States senator?
It should. That along with a lot of the other statements he's made, because he's gone completely far right extreme on really. He also made a statement where he called out the vice president recently, saying that she cares more about migrants than she does about Americans in this country. And then he ended that statement and he said, "You know, she was elected to represent this country." Now that was intentional, right? Again, it's a feeding that notion that the election was fraudulent. So he is doing these things calculated to play to that conspiracy theory base. And that's also what's dangerous, is that continues to be fed over and over and over again.
Seems to be no end to that or interest in ending that.
J.D. Vance is peak America 2021. One, he has an Ivy League education. He's graduated from Yale.
Yep.
Two, he owned a hedge fund, right?
He did.
Got a shit ton of money.
And he's being funded now by Peter Thiel. Yeah. To the tune of millions of dollars for his race.
So, and he writes this book, Hillbillyology, which was really good.
It was a great book. And it was lauded by a lot of progressives. Yes. He was invited on the talk show circuit on MSNBC, CNN. And he made himself out to be this guy who's part of the establishment, but I think rightfully said elites have ignored, Appalachia for so long, and these blue collar white people in Appalachia who are suffering and their concerns have been ignored and their economic issues. And we need to draw attention to this. And everybody was like, "You're right." That made sense.
He was standing at a spot with that book where he could have led a really important conversation in the United States. He could have contrasted what's happened in Appalachia to those folks to what happens to black folks in this country. We can talk about generational poverty among white people. And why does that exist? How does that contrast with other races? He did the work to have important conversation with him as the lead. And he made a decision. I'm flushing it all for power.
Yeah.
For power.
And he has money, too.
He has money. He knows better. He has money. And he doesn't need to do this.
You can compare his televised statements and recorded audio statements from before he decided to make this 180 pivot and become a Trump lackey to now, and it's like night or day. You can tell that he just made the decision in his head, I'm going to completely transform who I am and what I say and what I believe in, and that's what he's done. And it's been remarkable to just see that, and no qualms about it. Like
J.D. Vance is a cynical grifter who doesn't need to be cynical and doesn't have to grift.
No.
He's just doing it for money.
That's it.
And I think we can't move on without talking about Tucker Carlson a little bit in that vein, because that's what Tucker Carlson is. He's smart enough, intelligent to know better. So Tucker goes on this thing that the NSA is spying on him. Yeah, you dumb shit, because you called Putin. Of course that he got kept up in it.
You're going to have your phone tapped after that.
He knows the difference between getting caught up in a sweep and being targeted. But he uses this data with his audience who doesn't know that to weaponize against the NSA when he knows that's not what happened. Again, he's smart enough. He knows enough. He's just doing it for power.
And the way that this is all public now, who does this benefit? It benefits Putin. I mean, he's the one sitting back relishing this now, right? Because you have this talk show host who's followed by millions of Americans who is now on the NSA and blaming them for what's going on. And that's exactly what Putin would like to see. I mean, it's just it plays right into him. I saw a statement this week that describes people like Tucker, people like J.D. Vance, people like Laura Ingraham. These are all people who do know better and pretend not to, right? They've made this decision that money matters more than principle and that the truth ultimately. And so the term for this that I've seen, which I think makes sense, is called elevated stupidity. And this has become a phenomenon now in our psyche and in our politics. So standard stupidity is saying something that you know is demonstrably false, like 2 + 2 = 5. Elevated stupidity is when you say 2 + 2 = 5 and you believe it's the case because of your erudition and your background and your caliber and your what you've been brought up to believe and the fact that you're intelligent. And not only do you say 2 + 2 = 5, but when you get called out on it or it's disputed by somebody, you immediately decry cancel culture. You go on the TV shows, you sign a book deal, you parlay it into a national media campaign. So it's the idea that you say something is false and you believe that just by virtue of arguing, your ability to argue makes up for it and that it's the argument that matters and it's the way that you argue that matters and that it doesn't really matter. The truth no longer matters. It's your argument that matters. And that overtakes the truth. And that has become the way we do discourse in America on the truth.
I'll give you discourse is broken.
I'll give you a practical example. That Cruz got to Senate in 2012, right? And he filibustered the budget proposal, right? To block Obamacare. So Ted Cruz made a giant spectacle of himself, stopped the government from running on an attempt to repeal Obamacare, which at the time would have required Obama's signature. That's elevated stupidity. Right. The whole exercise is a complete waste of time.
Knew it wasn't going to go anywhere. Yeah.
And he knew it wasn't going to go anywhere, but he chose to do it anyway. Yeah.
Again, it's the idea that the argument you're making, the way that you're doing it, backed up by your brains and your intelligence and your methods matter over the truth.
And doesn't it matter now that I'm just doing it? It doesn't matter that there's going to be no outcome. It doesn't matter that this has no chance to succeed.
Right.
It doesn't matter that I'm grifting money from you to support this effort. I'm doing it. I'm fighting for you, Brandon. That's really what the Republican Party has deteriorated
there's
into.
There's no negative consequences for the people doing this.
No. I'm going to win the election.
Made me think of something about Russia. So with Trump and the administration kind of in bed in the background with Russia and now Tucker Carlson and all the hacks and everything, what do you think Russia would have to do to be considered an adversary by the right now? Anything?
Launch an open attack on us?
A land war, I guess. An air attack or something?
I mean, are we doing anything about Russia and their cyber attacks?
I saw a headline today, Biden promises to hold them accountable. Okay, yeah.
How do you do that? Like, what is the mechanism for holding them accountable? That's the thing. And nobody's been able to...
Trump's going to pay no accountability price for launching these stupid lawsuits. No. If anything, he's going to raise a bunch of money. Oh, and by the way, folks, if you're giving to his PAC, and Brandon, you know these laws a little bit more than I do, all that money you're giving him can be used for things like paying Ivanka consulting fees. It can be used to buy cars and things for the staff. When you're giving to that PAC, you're basically...
It's not used for his reelection.
No.
There's a wide, wide variety of things he could use that money for.
And just like his campaign, the operators of his PAC are master manipulators and determining how that gets utilized and written off. And
But it's completely legal for him to hire somebody for X amount of high dollar for consulting that just comes right back to him.
They've been doing that for years.
And, yes.
You know, some of that has come out with this New York case against him with the Trump Organization. But it's those same tactics that he's done in business, and he just brought those into the political arena. There was no difference.
We really haven't talked any about that because I don't. I have so many friends that just want the kill shot on Trump, that they just want everything. This is the one that gets him. This one gets him. This
not
isn't
gonna happen.
It's not
going to
happen.
It's not going to get him.
This isn't going to get him.
I mean, the only thing I can think of is possibly this is the first volley in a sustained, you know, campaign that's going to include more that comes out where they're going to really do the charges. But if this is all that they have, this is going to get him.
And again, I'm not defending the Trump Organization. The dude got $150,000 worth of benefits over 10 years. I mean, okay, yeah, that shouldn't have happened. I'm pretty sure that's not very shocking.
Of the long list of things to be offended by, that's not near the top.
We've all worked at companies where something like that, somebody got a benefit in some way. And $150,000 to your CFO every year for a multinational company, that's not a I'm not saying it's not illegal. I'm not saying they shouldn't prosecute him. What I'm saying is if it wasn't Trump, they wouldn't have prosecuted him. And they probably, if they were even looking for corruption, in most cases, they probably wouldn't even point it at this.
Right. And because this all goes back years and years with the Trump Organization itself, I would think that there is more from when he was president, because he was the first president to not separate himself completely from his business. You know, he remained in control of the trust, his family members, some of whom were employed.
His sons ran it, though, right?
Right.
He didn't run it. His sons did. Yeah.
The brain trust of Eric and Don really drove that home.
But then you still had people like Jared and Ivanka, who were White House employees, who were on the taxpayer dime, who were also involved with the business. So you had this entanglement. And so I think that's where, if there's going to be any charges, that's where they're going to come from. It's going to come from the failure to completely separate himself from those business activities and the conflict of interest issues that occurred.
Nobody feels sorry for Trump that the government's picking on him. He created this situation himself.
Right.
If he would have followed some basic norms, probably would have left him alone. But he's created this entire situation that now he's just got to lie in.
Well, he's always operated like the law didn't apply to him and he could always get around it. And he has said as much. I mean, you can dig back. I mean, going back to like the 90s, but he has said that, you know, he can fight the law with lawyers, and he's always done that. And he has typically fought. I don't know how he keeps lawyers on staff, though, because he has a habit of not paying them. One of the
results, you name three lawyers that Trump has dealt with? I can. That's a lot of advertising for free. Yeah.
That is. But I mean, even like Giuliani hasn't been able to collect from representing him on all those election losses.
Did you see his GoFundMe got like $900 to it or something?
Oh,
he started
no.
a GoFundMe.
Yeah.
He had a GoFundMe to pay for his legal things. And I think it was like $3,900 or something when they closed it down.
Oh,
it was some ridiculous amount. Let's stop talking about Trump and pivot to Jason. You sent out a really interesting article on some big tech stuff that we wanted to get into.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so to make it super relevant, Friday, Biden's team announced that they're going to propose a bunch of executive actions. I guess maybe propose isn't the right word. They're going to attempt to push through a bunch of executive actions. And I did take a few notes. So it's using 12 different agencies, primarily FTC and Justice Department. And the point is to, you know, quote unquote, rein in big tech. So here's our topic that both the right and the left seem to want to do something on. Biden's group is talking about five key points. And one is to more vigorously enforce antitrust laws. And I think, you know, in general, this sort of makes sense because it seems like it's the Wild West of mergers and acquisitions right now. But the sentence that I thought was really interesting in that section was that they're going to I don't have the wording, but it's basically to allow to go back and look at prior mergers and acquisitions that they felt weren't enforced correctly.
Really?
So can you imagine
change.
Some merger acquisition happens, call it, you know, use your favorite example, Instagram and Facebook or whatever. And if they didn't feel that it was properly reviewed, they can go back and attempt to do something.
How
do you unwind that?
It makes no sense.
So that would mean that there's no statute of limitations.
Yep. I found the language is challenge prior bad mergers.
I have no clue what practically that means.
Yeah. And let's see, they want to prioritize enforcing antitrust laws against dominant internet platforms, which is pretty generic. Are you talking about your ISP or are you talking about Facebook?
Right.
They want to create nutrition labels for ISPs. They're going to show you hidden fees and maximum and minimum bandwidths. They want to restore net neutrality laws, which is one of the things that Trump's
I could go for that.
Yeah. Enforce new privacy rules to make sure that your data cannot be used for market dominance.
All good.
And the fifth one is right to repair. Repair rules. So your Apple or your Google device that breaks, you know, instead of having to take it into the Apple store or some Google authorized service provider, there's published manuals that let you take apart the thing and put device a new battery in or whatever.
Yeah, agnostic. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
About five people would enjoy that. Sure.
I like the idea that you can go to you break it, I fix it thing or whatever on the corner and they take care of it. So some of these make sense. Some of these seem like they're consumer based and consumer focused and maybe have
you got to talk into your mic, Jason.
That top one though on antitrust laws sounds super vague and super dangerous depending on how it's done.
I would love to find a concise set of rules to where the government would not let two companies merge together. Has there ever been an instance where two software companies tried to get together and the government said no?
I can't think of an example with software companies. You see it with the telco stuff sometimes.
I get
right?
that. I mean,
the T-Mobile Sprint one got held up for a long time while that was reviewed.
Right.
But what would the criteria
can't remember the last
be?
One, yeah.
Too big, too profitable, too whatever?
If it created undeniable market dominance, some fancier legal language around that, prevents innovation in the market because you're the only one that can do it.
I mean, even outside of mergers, I don't even remember, was Microsoft the last tech company to be slapped by the FTC? And that was back in the 90s. So it's been that long.
And that wasn't even acquiring a company. No. That wasn't merging. That was bundling their own software, right?
And by slap, that was a mild slap.
Time it felt huge because they were dictating the software that it could be installed with the operating system.
But it didn't hinder their dominance at all. Yeah.
Yes and no. I mean, Microsoft was the number one tech company, right? And then fast forward to now, it feels like they're maybe fourth or fifth. And you could argue that that influenced how they adopted the internet within the software that they built. I think they kind of didn't have their eye on the ball early enough in the first place. And that was probably strategically more of an error on their part, but they certainly got hampered by that.
So you sent out this really interesting article by a guy who's like an insider in the market.
Yeah. So on this theme about how you might regulate big tech and if you want to regulate big tech, there's this guy named Steve Yeagy, and he's kind of famous in geeky circles. He worked at GeoCities. He worked at Amazon for a long time. He worked at Google. He's a well-known programmer, software engineer guy, edits programming languages for fun, you know, that kind of thing. And he was at Amazon early enough that he was kind of in Bezos's inner circle. So as far as bona fides, like he's an intelligent guy. He's good at writing and he knows a lot about the inside of the industry. So for a few years now, he's published essays, and there's one that he published in May on Medium, which I don't know if we can link to it or whatever, but it's primarily about big tech and China. And when you first say those two phrases, it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense, right? Well, some of his argument there that we should get into maybe in some detail is how we compete against China and other foreign nationals in technology and the education required to compete. So I'll pause there because I know you guys read it too. He definitely drew a few points on there, but that's the intro of what we want to talk about, right?
Yeah. I loved that article. I loved it the way it was written. It was very easy to read. And his data was kind of, his presentation was to the point. The big things that I took out of that article is, number one, China has stolen everything they need to steal. There is no IP left that they haven't gotten their hands onto. And the idea that they're stealing tech, they've been doing that forever, and culturally, they will continue to do that. The Chinese look at IP theft as a wah, wah, wah. If you didn't want me to take it, you should have locked it up.
Their moral compass is different, right? They see the reason to compete is to win. And
correct.
Therefore, the means justify the ends, right?
And the Chinese know we're coming from a lap down. The only way we're going to pull even is with a little chicanery, and they just have no problem with it if that's what it leads to.
Well, and I think as Americans, we can be just patriotic enough to not realize that others consider us the man, in quotes, you know, And so,
in the good way.
Yeah, not in a good way. China sees us as the man. And if you're stealing something from the man, then, you know, you're giving it to him and you're doing something good for yourself. So the baseline of this is that China knows everything we know. Plus, so yes. They're not behind anymore. No. At a baseline from technology, whether you're talking about sending a man to the moon, or artificial intelligence, photo analysis, drones, military, rocketry, eavesdropping, you know, whatever tech based thing you can think of, choose something under STEM. They've got the same baseline, if not better.
And I love the line where he's talking to a reporter and he says, yeah, Huawei is really going to hit Apple hard. And she looks at him and says, what's Huawei?
One of the world's biggest technology companies.
Huawei is the second biggest manufacturer of phone device of smartphones besides Samsung. And just for scale, they have 10,000 engineers at Huawei and the backing of the Chinese government. They're pretty powerful.
Yeah. And you know, when we think about China, we think about how can we enforce intellectual privacy laws? How can we enforce human rights? How can we negotiate with them? And some of the premise of this article is you can't negotiate. In fact, he uses the analogy of China's a hurricane, and you can't run away from the hurricane. All you can do is prepare for it. It is coming. In fact, it might already be here.
Well, and that's what he seems to say, right? The cat is already out of the bag. Like, it's not a question of will China be dominant? They are. And so we're left, like, our only go-to is to be able to try to compete with them. That's it. And I like how he said too that China was playing a whole different game, you know, this entire time than we were. And you had companies like Google that are all about, you know, democratizing data. And so they went into China with that mission when China was all about trying to get everything they could from Google and replicate that and build their own alternative. And so again, it's an example of where you have these big tech platforms that come in with different motives and different agendas that are more Western based and somehow believe that that's going to just change the way things are done in China, and it doesn't.
That's right. Google tried to approach with some sort of like, we're going to provide all the world's information for free. And China's like, that's not how we work.
Yeah.
And one of the scarier parts of it, I think it used China and India as an example of how American technology companies are so embroiled in local politics spread across the globe that they know nothing about, that they actually illustrated a story, I think it was in India, where employees of Amazon were jailed and potentially tortured to force executives at Amazon to bend their will to what India wanted done there. Yes. This is India. We're not even talking about China.
Well, yeah, that's scary.
Chinese tech companies are not founded on a cult of personality. They don't worship entrepreneurship. They worship getting something done.
The culture ahead.
This is a cultural lesson, especially around tech, that we really, really, really need to embrace. How many tech companies in the last 5 years have been billion-dollar entities that they wash out and you realize this was a Ponzi scheme led by somebody with good hair and knew how to talk? I mean, Theranos
Elizabeth Holmes.
Yeah. She's the alpha example of that. She came out and promised the world one prick of blood and we can do 300 tests. No, you can't. And she lied her way to $9 billion. While we're farting around with that, China is building things.
Yeah. This podcast, the first half of it, and what we've talked about so often in the last year, all this cultural division, all this stuff we're focused on here in the U.S. Meanwhile, they're running laps around us.
Wow.
And we're talking about technology today, but in the past, we've talked about the infrastructure stuff. For every pothole here we have, they're building a skyscraper somewhere. And yeah. I mean, and we can just laugh at it because we do, right? And we just ignore it. And then in 20 years, we're this minority party in the world.
Well, the hurricane's a good example because hurricanes are powerful, but they're slow moving. You know it's coming. And I think the hurricane analogy is we're sitting in like Tupelo, Mississippi right now. We're the one saying, it ain't going to hit us. It's not going to be that bad.
Yeah.
And Katrina's out there just slowly every day getting closer and closer to it. What I liked about, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So we've presented all this context for the essay, and I think really he lands on two points that are both worth talking about, right? And because, of course, we've identified this super large, hairy, vague problem, right? How to compete with China, how to stay at the front of innovation and technology on the world stage. And so how do you fix that? Well, his first solution is, if we're not paying attention to education, we're completely missing the boat. And our ability to compete with China or anybody else that's attempting anything in the long term is educating our workforce. And as Americans, we seem to have the wrong focus there, right? We're making education harder to get. Cost of education goes up. We have this aversion to elites and Ivy educated people. And instead, what we do is we train people, we give them a great advanced degree, and then we send them off somewhere else. How many times have you heard us poke fun at politicians and their Ivy League tower, their fancy education, their fancy speech? There's an example of somebody, we don't have to agree with their politics, but they were educated and they can think through some of these complex problems that exist in the world. And instead, we're running the other direction.
Well, and it speaks to, I think, the title of another great book called The Death of Expertise. We look down now on expertise and on that type of knowledge that comes with it. And that has become a rallying cry. And so that has hurt us, I think, globally in terms of being able to compete.
So, Jason, are you saying that in Chinese culture, they don't vilify people that have education and they don't use high-end education as a way to whip up people and make people mad and resentful if they don't have it?
We have cultural arguments over whether or not you can use the word doctor in front of your last name, right? There, it's celebrated. It's a cultural improvement if you've got a high education. I mean, there's the stereotype of the South Joko Asian parent who forces their kid to sit over books all day long and get straight A's. Like, that's looked down upon by most citizens. Why is getting really great grades and being really well educated looked down upon?
And getting really great grades in STEM stuff.
Yeah.
De-emphasizing things that don't lead to anything being built.
Yeah.
China has always been very successful too in really promoting and sending their graduates to the United States and Western countries for advanced studies. And then they return
and, they go, back
and go back to China and then help build up that intelligence infrastructure at home.
Yeah. What was your second point?
The second one came around whether or not big tech should be broken up and if that's actually counterintuitive to what would allow us to be competitive. And I know you want to talk about that, so I'll just
pitch it. My only thing was, I loved it because he said, when I was listening to that, it changed my thinking. Think of big tech as a form of our military, basically. If big tech were relabeled, oh, by the way, these are a collection of people who know the most about cybersecurity and how to enforce it and how to be secure, that in the country. Think of them that way. And if we're ever going to secure our infrastructure, we're not going to do it by vilifying Google, Amazon, Facebook. That if we break them up, if we make them weaker, if we take resources away from them, what we're really doing is opening up a gigantic hole that China is simply going to drive a freight train through. Yeah.
They built their own Amazon. They built their own search engine. They built their own TikTok, right?
Alibaba, if I'm saying that right?
Yeah, that's
I mean,
the Amazon.
It's not as big as Amazon, but it's pretty damn big.
It's huge, huge. In fact, and WePay, it's like it's all integrated on everything they do. Look, I love hating on Facebook. I think it's just disastrous to our culture. But I can also see if you break that up, now, even though it's a terrible source of misinformation for our public, somebody else, let's say China, will come in, build the exact same product, and now you've got them controlling the misinformation.
And if they break up Facebook into smaller chunks, they divide the talent, they divide the pool of people that really know this stuff to work, and now we compete against each other. So if I'm on one of the baby Facebooks, I'm using the AT&T kind of baby bell, now I've got to cut corners, I've got to be more out there to get back. I just don't think people have thought this through.
And if China develops a competitor to Facebook that would gain global dominance, think about the security implications of that for Americans who use that in their data. And there's no control at that point.
I think that's called TikTok.
Well, and I was just going to say, so you have TikTok, which is a microcosm of that, right? And there's the valid security concerns around that. But I mean, TikTok, I mean, is on one scale. But I mean, if you're talking about something on the scale of like Facebook and just the wealth of data that goes through that, because TikTok is a video sharing platform, it's a specific mechanism. It doesn't have all of the same data that you would get from something like a Facebook. I mean, that would be a whole different level.
This is just so fascinating because it is counterintuitive to our core as Americans. I mean, you think we have this inbuilt sense of fairness, competition, innovation, entrepreneurialism, and ultimately what this essay is arguing is potentially that leads to failure.
I think what I read in that article is China has decided they're going to manipulate both ends. We're going to do education. And another big thing that he hit on is they have basically wiped out extreme poverty in China. So what's so scary to me about China is obviously they've got some people studying some of their history and their own history, because they know that the two ways you lose power as an authoritarian is peasant uprising or palace coup. So they knew to pull this trick off, the first thing we have to do is we have to raise everybody's level of living standard. Without that, people are going to get pissed and disinterested, and we got a problem on our hands. So the first thing they did is they wiped out poverty, and they made a deal with their people. We're not going to give you the ultimate level of freedom that we may explore in the United States, but we're also not going to throw you out there on your own and do nothing. Let's say when you get sick and you need to go to a doctor and you wipe your family out. So I think China first did something smart with saying, we've got to get the people on board with this, and we understand how people, we understand what's going to get them on board. The second thing too is, I mean, Mao led China from 45 to 79. China was an absolute embarrassment during that era. To give you an example, mid 50s or so, huge drought in China. They can't feed themselves. This is a reoccurring problem because their agriculture sucks so bad. And they have all kinds of famine and shortage. The Chinese government's response to this is, well, birds eat a lot of grain, so we want our citizens to kill birds. And they kill tens of millions of birds. Well, what do birds eat? Insects. What do insects? Oh, crap. Now we've got, and my point being is that for 40-ish years, they were not only were they not a functioning government. Have you ever read any about the Great Leap Forward and what that was about, where they thought they could mentally woo themselves? My point being is that China's modern history is an embarrassment, and that is what's driving them. That is what's driving this culture to succeed. We are not going to be laughed at anymore. We're not going to be this weird, I don't even know what Mao, whatever the shit that was. We're all done with that. We're not going to be laughing stocks anymore. We're not going to be jokes. And we're going to grab that brass ring number one position in the world. And how we're going to do it is we're going to get a whole bunch of people all pulling in the same direction. And we can do that because we've set it up that way. America,
we can't get everybody pulling in one direction.
What's scary is we just might be entering the logical conclusion of what this version of America is. China senses that. So as more partisan and pulled apart as we get, the more they're going to come together. This will only last for a certain time of China, because once people get the taste and realize, okay, you've given me a little, you take some restrictions off, I can get a lot. But China has a fundamentally different bargain they're making with their people that I think is going to get them a very different result than what they've gotten in the past.
And I think now when we see the news headlines and we hear our congressional representatives talk about reining in big tech and this legislation that Biden wants to push through, this is why this is such a critical time, because somehow we have to keep the spirit of what it means to be an American entrepreneur and a balanced playing field and all these things that we cherish, while still allowing enough unbridled growth to be competitive on the global marketplace. And those two things conflict. How do we get through that? That's something that's a challenge for the age right now, because it'll be over in 50 years.
Yeah. Yeah. And if we don't do something to pivot quickly, they're just going to scream past us.
Yeah.
The other troubling trend is that China has made substantial progress in suffocating the just known political dissent and epicenters that exist within their country or on the periphery, Taiwan and Hong Kong. They utilize the pandemic as pretext for really stamping down opposition in Hong Kong, changing the political makeup. Hong Kong is a shadow of its former self. And part of that, too, is that Hong Kong had open access to these big tech platforms, and there was open communication. There was a lack of censorship. That is gone now. And the political structure has changed in Hong Kong. And they've been able to stifle that city's long tradition of dissent that has always occurred.
So that's basically making sure the palace coup doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So the first decade ish, or the last decade, was take care of the peasants. And I'm using peasants in its historical context, so chill out. So take care of that. So that doesn't happen. And now they've locked down the palace coup. No power. There is no big government shift coming in China. This is their, they're going to ride or die with Xi to whatever this natural conclusion of this cycle is.
And the story of Hong Kong over the last year was underreported and understated, but it is frightening because that represented one of the best hopes for a population in China that's well-educated, that's pro-democracy, that, you know, thinks differently to flourish. And China took advantage. They've been waiting because, again, they think long game. So they think years and years ahead. And so they swooped in and they've been effective. And so that's...
Brandon, do you think China's accelerating some of its plans when they look over here and just see what an absolute cluster we are? And you mentioned with Hong Kong, we offered no resistance to that.
No. Well, and again, they're making noise. They're being extra belligerent towards Taiwan and the strait, you know, just outside Taiwan. So they've been moving in warships. Clearly, they're trying to be provocative and provoke a response by the U.S. And the timing isn't accidental or coincidental. It's with the polarization that's happening here and all of our turmoil because they know we're distracted, and the best time to make progress militarily and politically and regionally in Taiwan is when we're distracted, because we're not going to have the same united will to defend Taiwan in that case. I mean, without a doubt.
But there's a kernel of a way to be united as a people here against China as a competitor. Yeah. But if you look at the rhetoric from the last couple of years, it's, you know, it's about the China virus or what happened in Wuhan. Like it's all, it's like, whether it's racially intoned or not, it's focused on the wrong things. It's like, yes, they're a competitor, but we're over here taking the clickbait article headline rather than thinking through what it means culturally for next 50 years.
It's like, we don't know what we're competing with them on. It's like, we know they're a competitor.
It's, we lash out like a child.
Yeah. But it's like, so how are you going to beat them? I don't know. We just don't like them. Yeah. We just compete with them. Yeah. Over what?
We can't explain why we don't like them. We just don't like them.
We just don't do it. Brandon, do you think the UN would ever put Taiwan in the, join the, what's what they try to do to Ukraine? I'm sorry, I lost my words all of a sudden. Would they put them in the thing where if they attack, somebody attacks us, you attack all
NATO?
Of us?
NATO.
I'm sorry, NATO. Okay. I apologize. I was going the wrong direction.
That's not UN.
That's the NATO. NATO. Would we ever, I mean, if we put Taiwan into that, into our NATO pact, that would be probably the strongest message we could send to China right now.
Well, it would. They would go into the NATO pact because the NATO pact is very tightly controlled and it's based on the whole North Atlantic defense from.
But that's
from
what I'm saying.
But a similar pact, right? I mean, we could conceptually create a similar pact for Asian allies and put them in it to a pact. We've talked about it with other allies in the region who have faced threats from China.
We did with Japan at the end of World War II, right? You can't have a military, but if anybody attacks you, we'll be there.
And Japan is one of our allies now, too, especially against China. So, you know, if you look at countries like India and Japan, we could put them in a pact. We would need to do something. I don't think at this point, if China invaded Taiwan tomorrow, we do not have the political will to do anything.
There's no way.
To defend Taiwan. The other underreported thing is China, during the last year especially, has leveraged the ability to geopolitically expand their influence in Southeast Asia. So they have provided resources and new trading routes to India. They've expanded their partnerships with Turkey. So some of these countries that have long been considered allies of the United States, they're reaching out to because they are trying to gain a foothold and looking at how they can expand their power and influence.
They're building schools and cities in Africa.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm okay with us getting out of Afghanistan, but we also need to understand what we're doing. Yes, it's a tragedy that 8 or 9 service people died in the Afghan theater. I think last year there were under 10 deaths, 12 deaths in Afghanistan. More police officers died in major metropolitan areas in the line of duty than died in Afghanistan. And it cost us about $50 billion to keep a presence there. That's like 0.1% of our $700 gazillion, whatever our budget is. And one of the things we're getting for that is we're getting that women get to go to school in certain regions. We're getting that people feel safer. The idea that we're pulling out of that, why? It's a cheap, easy win for Biden. I get it. It's a we don't want to be in perpetual wars. I agree with that.
I mean, I think it does all go back to just the sentiment on that has changed so much over the last 20 years.
This is what drives me nuts. We spend on our military like we're Sparta. Right. And then we can't leave a few thousand dudes in Afghanistan to get some goodwill in a part of the country because we're protecting them against the Taliban. Biden came out and said the Afghanis deserve to pick their own government. That's horseshit. What they're going to get is the Taliban's going to run them over.
And when you leave in the middle of the night, you don't tell your allies there that you're leaving.
Why are we leaving?
And there's the and I don't know how they're going to work this out, but there are Afghans who have been allies and assisted our presence there this entire time. They need to be provided safe passage or some way to come to the U.S. or get out of the country, because they face danger as well. I mean, life and death, because they will be seen as having worked with Americans and the enemy. So there's that aspect of it. I don't know that we've thought through. And the fact is, they're trying to figure out how they're going to secure the airport, you know, with us leaving now. I mean, because the country is going to change. And so, yeah, I think clearly Americans said, we don't want to sustain presence there anymore. We have such a smaller footprint now because that has, you know, just been reduced to so much over the years. And, you know, there's this idea that we don't want it to become like, you know, Vietnam, where we just, it just went on and on. But at the same point too, it's an opportunity for somebody like China to then swoop in and to make some type of deal with the Taliban and to try to extract resources out of there. I actually think, you know, he was criticized and laughed at for it years ago, but Biden had made a comment that country should be divided into three. And that actually more and more seems to be logical, because Afghanistan has never existed as one geopolitical entity. When you talk about the rival tribes and ethnicities, it's just so hard to create a unitary government out of that country that is effective and also has control over the entire country. Because that's been the problem with the Afghan government over the past 20 years, is they just lack that control and authority. I mean, beyond the big cities, they don't have it.
I don't think there's anything specifically right now we are capable of doing to China to tamp down their march forward. That there's nothing that I don't see anything that we would have the political will to do, the militarily will to do.
The internal interest.
It feels like we've got a big internal fight coming. Yeah, that we need to concentrate on what that fight's going to be. As we wrap up, so I was listening to Jonah Goldberg this week, and he talked about there are three areas that we have to stop debating. There are three areas in this country that we have to realize we have reached the logical end, and we are at our best possible solution. And these are kind of the big liberal kind of concepts that, like, number one, we should stop fighting about that we are about individual liberties. This whole country and the whole ability to form a country where we have rights and those rights are perceived as coming from us, not from the government, is we've spent centuries fighting over the fact that we are not subjects, we are citizens. And as citizens, it comes as individual citizens, we have certain rights. And the role of government is to protect the rights of the individual, not the right of the group. I thought, yes, we should all be there. And if we're talking about anything other than that, we're regressing. We're not moving forward. The second thing that we should stop talking about altogether is government should be as small as it can be and localized wherever possible.
Which is one of the old school Republican arguments, the big right? One,
well, that's an old school liberal, classic liberal argument. Yeah. And the third one is, all government is only legitimate if it comes from a democratic process from the people it governs. Everything else is an illegitimate form of government that eventually dies. The only legitimate form of governmental power is when it has been granted by the people that are governed through a democratic process.
So this is something we should stop debating.
Yes. He's saying, yeah. And his argument is, if you're picking at those three areas, you're not interested in advancing the conversation or advancing the country. Actually, what you're doing is looking to go backwards. And we have to stop kind of this constant, we have to realize how long it took to get those three pillars in place, that everything we do, everything we enjoy is based on those three pillars. And if people are talking about them, they're typically talking about them in a historical reactionary environment. And I thought that was really interesting. And then I got to thinking, I've never been at a time in my life where all three of those pillars seem to be under simultaneous assault. And then if you throw a fourth rail in there of this country exists on 250 years of peaceful transition of power, I thought that one was on autopilot. if you put that in there too, why I think everything feels so weird right now is those, the things that we thought were settled. I mean, democracy is better than authoritarianism, right? I thought
we all agreed to that.
Did we agree with that? I thought that the individual rights of a citizen were way more important than the musings of a mob. Apparently, that's not true anymore. And I guess everybody under 30 just wants a strong central government, and they want all their problems handled by a central authority. I didn't think that's where we were at, but... I mean, if we loop this back to China, the fundamental agreement that the United States has with its citizens feels like it's being openly debated and encouraged to change in some way. And once that starts happening, where it ends up, history will tell you, you can't really be sure.
So we're not debating things on the fringe anymore. We're in the core, core architecture of how we're built.
The fundamentals of what has governed us for, like you said, 250 plus years. And I think that's what's scary, because I reflect on this constantly. I feel like we are living at a turning point in history. Like the U.S. can go in one direction, or we could go slide back and go in a completely different direction, something that we have not seen or anybody who has been a part of our democratic experiment has ever seen. And so the question is, which direction do we go?
Now, we're not arguing which way to tip the spear. We're arguing, should we have a spear at all?
And what's so appalling at this is we were the model for democracy around the world, right? I mean, we gave birth to democracy in so many other countries. You have countries like Australia that have, you know, modeled their democracy after so many countless and continue to do so. And so now they're looking at us as we question our democracy, and we've, you know, barely, you know, we had some hiccups even more than that last year. Like, I mean, and what does that say? Again, and going back to China, I mean, China is relishing this, right? Because if we crumble or even slide back a little bit, it gives more strength to China to go in and to, and it also gives strength to similar autocratic leaders who are trying to rise up in many of these countries. Because what's happening in the United States isn't happening only here in isolation. Like, there are similar authoritarian movements in many countries around the globe, including our Western allies in Europe.
It's rhetorical fodder that what we have is failing. We're not going to go do that.
Right.
Is that rhetorical fodder? I mean, she seems to be able to put a pretty good case in China that if we had to pick, would you pick that? I mean, I think what scares me is you see these surveys of guys, kids under 30. And I apologize. I know 30, you're an adult, but yada, yada, yada. And they, like, 62% say socialism's the way to go. Now, I know that they don't know what that means, but what it means is they – how big a belief and how deep is the belief in these three big things that I always thought undergirded our political system? And if that's falling away, to be replaced by what?
And perhaps education's already failed that section of the population to understand the pros and the cons of these different forms of government and how it's been built here. That's gone then. How do you can't go back and do it again.
Yeah. And I think part of the problem is, I think many of these kids don't know what, like, true socialism is, right? I mean, that word has been bastardized to such a degree in our political discourse. And, you know, anything and everything gets labeled as communism or socialism by the far right.
Yeah.
You know, and so if kids are thinking of, like, Scandinavian countries, they may think of them as socialist countries. They're not technically at all. And in some aspects, they're actually more free market than we are as a country, and would love to have that whole conversation sometime. But again, so I think that also enters into it, but it muddies the waters, right? Because you do, if they don't know enough to actually know what socialism is, that's a whole nother challenge that we have it confronted.
Well, I would love to ask somebody sometime.
Goes back to education.
I'd love to ask somebody, what type of government does America have? And have somebody look at me and say, we have a representative republic, which really focuses on the rights of the minority. Because if you know that, and if you look at the government in that way, a lot of things make sense.
Right.
If you just know enough to know, in some ways, this is functioning as designed, that, you know, the Senate is not a bug, it's a feature. It gives you a whole different perspective to why things work the way they do.
Maybe it's good that things move so slow.
it's not a bad thing. I mean, moving fast is historically proven to come with a lot of stuff.
Case in point, see France and, you know, the French Revolution, and then all of the governments and number of constitutions that France has had over the years.
Yeah. They went through five. We stayed in South Korea for so long because it took them like four republics to get it right.
Right.
After the Korean War, South Korea had an emperor for a while,
yeah.
I think, because they just didn't know what to do.
And look, you know, Japan, we actually handcrafted their democracy after World War II, which is fascinating. I remember back in, I think it was high school, having to watch a video about post-war, how we built their democracy from the ground up. And we sent Americans over, and they had these debates about making the emperor a figurehead and exactly how, you know, he should not be involved in policy and what the two branches would look like. And they've had now a stable democracy since then, and one of the world's leading democracies. So we have this incredible history of exporting democracy around the world, and now we're at the point where we're questioning our own commitment to it.
Maybe we should save this for next week, but what's happening in southern Missouri with COVID is just an absolute disaster.
Did I send you the screenshot of the fire chief the other day who basically said it's a mass casualty event? This is the fire chief of Springfield. He said, we are watching a mass casualty event right before our eyes sounding the alarm. Like, it is just appalling. They had 19 deaths from June 21st to July 4th.
All preventable.
Right. Over 200 in the ICU now. These are all people that are not vaccinated. And it just goes to show, like, night and day, vaccination matters. Yeah. This is what happens when you don't.
And only 39% of Missourians vaccinated. And Missouri is the leading state in the nation in new cases.
Yep. You get into southern Missouri.
Doubled in 30 days.
They are shipping people to Kansas City because they don't have any ventilators left. I think we probably need to pick this up on another section, but if you're a person who's building your brand on anti-vax, fuck off. There's no other way to say it.
Well, and Fox News continues to do that. And did you say...
The head of the largest hospital system in Springfield went on local TV begging Fox News to please, could you tell people to get the vaccine? You're the number one purveyor of news in southern Missouri. You could literally save lives if you told those three assholes that you have on from 7 to 10 to maybe give a shout out to the vaccine.
Or worse, quit talking about you're going to introduce matter into your bloodstream.
Yeah. And some of these feeder counties, for example, that feed into Greene County, where Springfield is, have vaccination rates as low as 13%. So that's what you're dealing with. And again, some of these more rural counties, they don't have their own hospitals. So all these people are coming to Springfield, and then their hospitals are being overwhelmed.
You know, hey, Candace Owens, if you want to build a brand on the back of dead people in Missouri because you have some weird thing about that's great. That's awesome. Just know there are people dying in parts of the country that you are directly contributing to.
Can I say something that might be a little bit uncouth, but this is the elephant in the room?
Oh my God. Yes.
This might be the second time in the history of the podcast.
Okay, Brandon, you were so potty mouthed on the last one that you said two curse words. So, all right, let's see it.
No. So I find it just, it shows, if we're going to talk about elevated stupidity, because I think this fits right into that dynamic that we talked about earlier, that these talking heads and the political class that is using this as grift to raise money about, you know, don't trust the vaccine, it's dangerous, what have you. So they are killing off their own base. That's what's happening. These, and by and large, these people that distrust the vaccine in rural areas are Trump supporters, Republicans. And so they are literally hospitalizing and killing them. And so that is only going to hurt them politically in the long run. So I don't understand, unless it's really just money short term, who cares about these voters, you know, whether or not they live and die. But it just strikes me that, like, politically speaking, if you're looking at elections ahead, like, this is not smart politics. I mean, because, you know, the people that are likely to vote Democrat or progressive are already vaccinated. And if you look at the urban-rural divide, they actually took a map of the states and how they win the presidential election and overlaid it with a map of vaccination rates. And it matches up almost completely with the highest vaccination rates in the states that went to Biden, the lower ones in the states that went to Trump.
If you live in Missouri, I can tell you, Governor Hee-Haw ain't going to help. He does not give two shits about this.
This stupid governor, I mean, so he was on TV talking to the press, I think, just on Friday, and he was saying, well, you know, these hospital administrators say that they don't have ventilators. He's like, I haven't heard that. He's like, there's enough, you know, at the state level. He's like, I think, you know, they don't know what they're talking about. Really? Like, they're the wow. own hospital heads who are in the front lines who are seeing this at their own hospitals don't know what they're talking about?
So how do we exist in a world where people will life and death lie to you simply to get you to click on a Twitter link? Because that's really what this is.
Well, and here's a vicious circle, right? Because the cases explode over the summer, fall comes around, kids can't go back to school because the cases are everywhere again. I'm going to have to move somewhere. I can't do that again.
Kids are going back to school.
And then we're not going to have any education going.
Yeah. If Biden came out and said, we're masking it up again, schools closed, that's not going to happen.
Because in some of these states, the vaccination rate is as low as, you know, 25%, 30%, 33%. And where this becomes an issue for all of us, right now, we're fine. And even with the variants. But if there's a large enough portion of the population that remains unvaccinated, they become a conduit for new variants to thrive and spread. And we could encounter a new variant that we are not resistant to with the current vaccines. And then the vaccine makers have to ramp up and create booster shots to tackle the new variant.
And then the narrative will be, see, your vaccine didn't work. I didn't need it in the first
place. Really, if we could just get 60 to 70% of the entire population to get vaccinated with this, we could drown out the existing variants, put a stop to that, and really just kind of cut this off. But we're not able to.
You want me to get a booster shot just so I don't get sick or other people don't get sick? Please. That's my Missouri thing. This literally makes me sad because I live in Missouri. I have kids in Springfield, both in college. And it just, I think they said there were people from ages 40 to 90 in the last month or so that had died of COVID. Yeah. And these are all 100%
preventable.
And I would love to talk to one of these people about why. And if it's because I'm just so damn sick of somebody telling me what to do, brother, I understand that. I get you. For a year and a half, you've been shit on multiple ways. I get that I just don't want to listen to anybody. But also too, you're being stupid.
Yeah.
And the shot.
I struggle with having sympathy for some of these people that end up hospitalized that are just so stubborn and refuse to get vaccinated when, okay, we have this amazing achievement. Within a year, we developed vaccines that are not only effective, but highly effective, more effective than vaccines we have on the market for anything else. When you're talking about 94-95% efficacy, that are being proven to be effective for the variants right now, that are going to be effective for years to come. So if we didn't have variants, we likely wouldn't have to get another shot for years. And yet you refuse to take it because you're buying into this conspiracy nonsense.
Maybe there'll be some tipping point where enough of those people do get infected and sick, hopefully not dead, that they start telling their neighbors, oh, I wish I did have the shot.
And well, and that's what it'll take. So there was a ABC News segment where they interviewed this couple in Arkansas, this woman who works as a nurse in a ER, but who was vaccine skeptic, and she did not get vaccinated, partially because she was pregnant and thought that it was going to have an adverse effect on her child. Well, she ended up contracting COVID and got it very severe. We ended up being hospitalized. They had to induce labor for her baby, who also tested positive for COVID, and her baby almost died because she was so sick. And her baby now is in a preemie unit, and you know, basically on support. Hopefully, we'll be fine. And her husband said, you know, he's like, yeah, well, you know, we're both vaccinated now. And he's like, if we would have just done that, like we could have, you know, I almost lost my wife and we almost lost baby. And he said, you know, here in Arkansas, you know, it came down to everybody has a different belief system and we didn't think anything of it. And I think those words were striking because he said belief system, right? And it's like, it's not, this isn't about beliefs. It's about like, this is something that works. You choose not to do it or you choose to do it. But it goes to show you how this has all been wrapped up in this mentality of, well, you have your beliefs, I have mine. Like, no, that's not the way any of this works.
You're wrong. Get the vaccine. We have, with the death of expertise, nobody has the moral or intellectual authority, I guess, to tell anybody what to do anymore. Go ahead and believe that. It's just going to make you sick. And it feels like America, we're just going to muddle along half sick. And that's just what it's going to be.
So I saved a screenshot from some wacky Republican activists in Kansas who back in at the end of December, I think it may have been first week of January, said that these vaccinations, everybody who's going to get vaccinated was going to be dead by June. So I think I'm at the point now, since June is over, I want to go back. And I haven't figured out the tack to take or how to be like, this didn't age well at all, but you know.
Do you care to comment on it?
Right. Want to revisit this post?
Yes.
I think that's our hour, because Brandon, you've got to get out of here. You've got something to do. Yep. I think we're good. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Two Men in the Middle. Make sure to give us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. Check out our website at twomeninthemiddle.com. Drop us an email at twomeninthemiddle@gmail.com or tweet at us at twomeninthemiddle. We'll see you next week.